Hey everybody, it's Pastor Brian Ross from Grace Life Bible Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We want to welcome you again to this midweek video. We've been trying to make a push here this week to finish our review and analysis of Daniel G. Hummel's book, The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism. This is the third video that I've released this week in this series as I attempt to finish this before the end of 2023. Like to welcome you to our YouTube channel here. If you haven't already done so, if you consider subscribing and ringing the alarm bell as a way of staying current with the ministry when we go live from the assembly building on Sunday mornings, as well as when we create content for you here midweek, we would certainly appreciate that. Also want to remind you about our Rumble channel here. We established this as an alt tech site should something happen to our YouTube ministry. So if you're into alt tech sites or like an alternative to YouTube, please consider checking us out and subscribing here on Rumble as well. My featured book this week is, again, two books. First is J.C. O'Hare and the Origins of the American Grace Movement, 1599 to 1958. Full-length feature church history book, co-authored with my former professor, Dr. Dale DeWitt, covering the life and ministry of J.C. O'Hare and the origins of the mid-acts dispensational position in the United States, as well as the American Grace Movement. So please consider checking that out if you're interested, as well as my book here, E.W. Bullinger, Rightly Dividing E.W. Bullinger, Assessing His Life, Ministry, and Impact. Another book here on a key figure in the history of dispensational truth with a brief sketch of his life. Primary focus is on the origin and development of the Acts 28 dispensational position in the writing ministry of E.W. Bullinger. So two very important figures in the history of dispensationalism. That you should know about. If you're interested, please consider checking those out as a way of supporting the ministry. We would certainly appreciate that. As I already said, we've been going through the book by Daniel G. Hummel, The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism, How the Evangelical Battle Over the End Times Shaped the Nation. We've been doing this since the summer, and we are trying to wrap this up before the end of the year. As always, we have the Google Books preview here that gives us some formatting to sort of use to frame this conversation. Last time, in the last episode, episode 21, I believe, if my memory is not mistaken, we finished part two, The Dispensationalist, 1900 to 1960. And so we are going to begin the third and final part of the book, which is The Pop Dispensationalist, 1960 to 2020. So things are definitely going to get interesting. They got pretty interesting in chapter 13 on dispensational politics, where we kind of see some of where Hummel is really going in that chapter. And then in chapter 14, we have the beginning of part three on the pop dispensationalists, 1960 to 2020. So let's get into chapter 14. As always, there is a brief introduction that Hummel provides, and then this time he divides the chapter into three different subsets, or subsections, I should say. Hal Lindsey, The Late Great Planet Earth, Prophets and Prophets, and Lindsey and Smith, The Jesus People. So let's get into this chapter. This chapter begins on page 233 of the book. And I'm probably going to read the entire introduction because it's important and it really gives a lot of information as far as framing up where things are at right now in the conversation. Hummel writes, 30 years into the fundamentalist movement, theological infighting was at a stalemate. Tempers continued to run high. Writing in 1957, Carl F. Henry bemoaned how, quote, many fundamentalists from the 1920s on had identified Christianity rigidly with premillennial dispensationalism. So this is a problem for Carl F. Henry that so many fundamentalists are identified as with premillennial dispensationalism. William E. Cox, writing in his Amillennialism Today, a direct response to Charles Ryrie's Dispensationalism Today, 1965, described the belief in, quote, a literal earthly materialistic millennium as a teaching, quote, arrived at only through a hyper-literal interpretation of obscure passages of Scripture, observing how defining evangelicalism hinged in part on settling these doctrinal disputes. John Walvoord complained that, quote, an evangelical, as opposed to a fundamentalist, is free to believe all that fundamentalists believe theologically. Or, if he prefers, he can deny all the fundamentals and still claim the same name. The term evangelical, Walver noted with concern, quote, only declares one in favor of the evangel or the gospel, but it does not in itself define them, define the term theologically. So this is where we start to see, we already saw this with the neo-evangelical insurgents, a divide beginning to emerge between so-called evangelicals and fundamentalists. The fundamentalists think the evangelicals are milquetoast, watered down, you know, sort of mealy mouth, teaching to the lowest common denominator type of a situation. Though consensus seemed farther away than ever, the previous generation's struggle for scholastic superiority had produced another generation of theologians eager to carry on the fight. The expansive growth of Dallas Theological Seminary under Wolverd pointed to a vibrant future for dispensationalism. Thousands of dispensationalists worked in pulpits, colleges, seminaries, nonprofits, and mission agencies across the United States and the globe. The pipeline of training grew with advanced schools at Talbot Seminary in Los Angeles and Grace Seminary in Winona Lake, Indiana. And there was potential for yet more growth, quote, accredited schools were taking DTS, Dallas Theological Seminary graduates, as faculty, though the school at the time was unaccredited. Recalled one student of the seminary's Heilcom, I'm not sure what that word means, 1960s. Accreditation by Southern Association of Colleges and Schools came in 1969 when enrollment soared past 400 and the school broke ground for its largest building expansion to date. So Dallas is accredited in 1969 is the main point there. Yet even as Dallas Seminary was fulfilling Chafer's vision to train men in the system of dispensational theology, seismic changes were afoot. Among the more than 60 graduates in Dallas's 1962 class was Harold Lee Hal Lindsey, a Houston native and ex-tugboat captain, and now the possessor of a master's degree in Greek New Testament from Dallas Seminary. In the 1970s, Lindsey's fame would outpace his teachers and that of Dallas Seminary itself, as he became one of the most successful authors of the decade and the most important popularizer of dispensationalism in the 20th century. The source of his notoriety began with a book marketed to baby boomers at the height of the counterculture. By 1970, after a few years as a campus ministry worker in California, Lindsey wrote a popularized version of the dispensational eschatology he learned at Dallas titled The Late Great Planet Earth, and then again written in 1970. The unabashedly unscholastic book went on to sell 10 million copies in the decade, doing more to familiarize Americans with the rapture and tribulation than any scholastic tome. It also spurred a process that would unravel the scholastic project and indeed lead to the demise of the system of dispensationalism itself. Now that is a jam-packed paragraph, okay? So let's unpack a couple of the key ideas. Hal Lindsey writes Late Great Planet Earth, and he presents not a scholastic 8-volume, you know, series on systematized dispensationalism. He presents it in a popular form in paperback. It sells 10 million copies in the 1970s and introduces people not at a scholarly highbrow Dallas Theological Seminary level to issues of the rapture and the tribulation, but he puts the cookies on the shelf down here where they can be popularly sort of read, consumed, and this is going to change things significantly according to what Hummel is asserting. He says that this changes things in two ways. It, number one, is going to lead to the unraveling of what he calls the scholastic project. That would be scholastic dispensationalism. And second, he says it's going to lead to the demise of dispensationalism itself. Well, so like I'm a dispensationalist. Many people watching this channel are dispensationalists. There are many dispensationalists writing other books. So the argument here that dispensationalism is diminished or you know has been demised, I'm not sure I accept that. However, I think Hummel is correct that the, as you read the book, there's an assessment here of Hal Lindsey's influence that is probably true as far as popularizing or pop dispensationalism is sort of where Hummel is going with this. The success of Late Great Planet Earth propelled Lindsey into consumer-driven world of mass-market paperbacks, which he would exploit for decades, but also further away from the influence of his scholastic teachers. Lindsey did not invent the commercialization of dispensationalism, but he monetized its theological tropes more efficiently than had anyone previously. In the process, he disrupted the project of scholastic dispensationalism and injected dispensational concepts into American popular culture at a moment when baby boomers were taking greater notice of religious ideas. Commercialization inflicted on dispensationalism, like so many areas of American religion, a drastic reorganization through the metrics of popularity and virility. The market evaluated the worth of the religious teaching on its own terms, creating an environment where scholastic dispensationalism struggled while its popular forms thrived. Again, this is a very interesting point that Hummel is making here. He's saying that once dispensationalism goes pop, the scholastic, highbrow, theologically oriented systems of Dallas Theological Seminary and Chafer and these guys are going to be outpaced by popular or pop dispensationalism, and Hummel is identifying this as starting with Lindsey. So let's get into the first subsection here, specifically on this. Page 235, second paragraph of the section. With a growing popular demand for accessible religious insights into social chaos, the erudition that scholastic dispensationalists had cultivated in their struggle for theological legitimacy was, in this new conflict, a liability. So what he's saying there is that the struggle that worked in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, when you had the confrontation between covenantal theology and dispensational theology, with then the new evangelicals emerging as a mitigating thing, the scholastic nature of the dispensational discourse, if you will, helped dispensationalism stake out a territory. What Hummel is saying now with the counterculture, that type of highbrow stuff isn't going to work anymore. And so what Lindsey's going to do is provide the cookies at the popular level for people to interact with dispensational concepts. Okay. So let me read that again. With a growing public demand for accessible religious insights on social chaos, the erudition that scholastic dispensationalists had cultivated in their struggle for theological legitimacy was, in this new context, a liability. Spiritual seekers outside the fundamentalist fold were interested not in a systematic theology, but in a presentation of religion that spoke to the contemporary moment. That is, for whatever I feel Hummel's issues are in this book, I think he's probably right about that. And I think it's still the case today. People's theology today, I said this to somebody a while ago, and I think it was a good observation. I'll let you decide for yourself. But people's theology today is at the level of the meme. That's all they have time for. Meme level theology. Okay. Meme level understanding of the scriptures. They don't even want to read a blog. They want a meme. They want a boom. There it is. No explanation. They want meme level theology. So I think that's true, that that's where people are at. Even in videos like this, you know, people say, well, keep your video to 10 minutes. You know, I've tried that for a while, but I couldn't cover any ground in 10 minutes. The videos sort of are what they are. But I understand that's why you've got shorts and TikTok and all this stuff, because people's attention spans, they're not willing to invest the kind of time, effort, and energy that they need to really do any sort of real theological Bible study research or anything like that. And they just want it now. And that's kind of what Hummel is saying about how Lindsey was able to sort of strike a chord. The era's defining work in this vein was The Late Great Planet Earth. The book was chock full of social observations, musings on military weaponry, and armchair diplomacy mixed with a simplified dispensational eschatology to make sense of the times. The first edition published by Evangelical Press Zondervan in 1970 featured on the back cover a still youthful-looking 41-year-old Hal Lindsey and promised, quote, prophecy for the new generation. Though born in 1929, Lindsey lumped himself with baby boomers. We have been described as, quote, the searching generation, he explained. We need so many answers to the large problems of the world, answers to the conditions of our nation, and most of all, answers for ourselves. Truth was elusive in the university classroom, he diagnosed. Only pain followed from faith and philosophy, astrology, sexual freedom, or science. These faddish sources of knowledge did not have the pedigree of ancient timeless truths enjoyed by the Bible. Let's give God a chance to present his views, he pleaded. Late great planet Earth also had an air of geopolitical urgency. The book was written in the aftermath of the Arab-Israeli War in June 1967, where 6 days of fighting witnessed near total Israeli victory. Israel extended its control over both the biblical Old City and East Jerusalem, the West Bank, encompassing the biblical lands of Judea and Samaria, the Golan Heights and the Gaza Strip, and the entire Sinai Peninsula. This stunning turn of events captured world attention. It also aligned with dispensational expectations that Jews would recapture the city of Jerusalem as a coda to the times of the Gentiles, Luke 21:24. Lindsey would articulate this expectation in nearly everything he wrote. Now, somebody asked me a question about modern day mid-ex dispensationalists and what seems to be their lack of support of Israel in a sort of Zionist way. Okay. Look, I've got no problem with the modern state of Israel, but what happens in this pop dispensationalism now is this is going to become at the popular level sort of what you do. And there's not a clear recognition of the fact that prophecy is not being fulfilled today during the dispensation of grace. The distinction between prophecy and mystery is blurred in this pop dispensationalism. This is going to become popular in the evangelical world. And as a result, there's going to be sort of this theological idea that if you want to be blessed, you have to support Israel. For me, as a mid-acts dispensationalist, I don't see prophecy being fulfilled today. So while it's interesting what's happening with Israel in the Middle East, okay, you cannot hang any specific prophetic utterance on some current event over there while the dispensation of grace is still in effect. And so what's going to happen with Hal Lindsey, though, is now that's going to change. That's going to become very prominent in pop dispensationalism. And trying to triangulate current world events with Israel, with biblical passages, to try to read the tea leaves, as it were, on how close the rapture might be or the tribulation. Regarding the Middle East, Lindsey was willing to speculate boldly where his seminary teachers were not. Rehearsing the standard dispensational teachings, late great planet Earth's core message was straightforward. Before the rapture and the return of Christ, three prophetic events had to be fulfilled. The return of the Jewish people to their biblical land, their capture of Jerusalem, and the real rebuilding of the sacrificial temple destroyed in the year 70 AD by Roman legions. By the mid-1960s, two of the three steps had improbably reached fulfillment in Lindsey's estimation. So Lindsey's saying they've been fulfilled. So this is going to now lead to an interpretation grid that's going to try to figure out, well, when is the last of the three pieces going to fall into place? Okay. So already at the popular dispensational level, the distinction between prophecy and mystery, between Israel and the church, is being lost, which is now going to lead to confusion in dispensational teaching, which will then ultimately further disparage dispensational teaching in the minds of some observers because they're not going to seem consistent or like they're able to figure out exactly or diagnose what's going to happen and when it's going to happen, though that's what they're claiming to do. Lindsay's, he predicted, based on typological reading of a parable in Matthew 24, that within 40 years or so of 1948, all these things could take place. The qualifications or so could allow Lindsay an escape hatch when in 1988 came and went without a rebuilt temple or rapture, but his confidence in the accuracy of biblical prophecy was palpable. So that's the problem, right? Lindsay says the rapture is going to happen in 1988. Doesn't happen. Okay? Lindsay's analysis repackaged the content of his scholastic teachings by updating their language and writing with contemporary cultural references about geopolitics. The rapture, with his pen, became the ultimate trip, while the Antichrist assumed the nickname Future Führer. Traditional concepts remain central: rapture and Antichrist, a third temple in Jerusalem, and betrayal of the Jewish people, a climactic battle of Armageddon, but the style was rebellious. This was not a complex theological treatise, Lindsay explained on the first page, but a direct account of the most thrilling, optimistic views of what the future could hold for any individual. Lindsay brooked no omnipotent third-person voices, no detached academic tones. He banished copious footnotes and welcomed instead what he calls chick, C-H-I-C, prose, exclamation points, and tabloid copy. Lindsay's innovation in form was a key ingredient to his success. He realized better than his teachers that old-time prophecy preaching could have mass appeal to a generation dropping out of institutional religion, but tuning into spirituality. It was ultimately popular with a massive segment of American readers. Late Great Planet Earth became the best-selling nonfiction book of the 1970s, with 10 million copies printed in the decade and 28 million by the end of the century. Late Great Planet Earth did not invoke the term dispensationalism once, but when it did appear in coverage of the book or in Lindsay's teachings, it became synonymous with Lindsay's apocalyptic timeline. Like the innovation of the prophecy chart more than a century before, Lindsay initiated the steady process of popularization by thinning out the theology and making it tantamount to its apocalyptic scenario. There you go. Okay. What Lindsay does is he reduces dispensationalism down to its end time scenario, so that the end time scenario of dispensationalism, rapture, Antichrist, tribulation, Armageddon, second coming, millennium, becomes sort of the popular understanding of it, never mind where those concepts come from, how they're come to be understood in that way. None of that is going to be involved in it, and so it's just going to become this sort of popular understanding. Now, I am reading a lot from this subsection because it's important. The book entered the bloodstream of American culture. I'm on page 237 now. The book entered the bloodstream of American culture, pioneering a subgenre of futurist geopolitical analysis, okay, that was expanding beyond the strictly fundamentalist market. New entries, of which Hal Lindsey was the most commercially successful, were aimed at broad readership of non-particular religious background. Alvin Toffler's Future Shock, 1970, which sold 6 million copies, diagnosed Americans with a collective psychological trauma brought about by, quote, too much change in too short a time. Okay, another one that's going to be published in 1968 was The Population Bomb. After the late Great Planet Earth sold 500,000 copies under Zondervan, the trade press Batinum Books picked up options for a mass market paperback in the same years it was publishing the first original Star Trek novels. The book's crossover appeal resembled another Batman mass market sensation of the era, Eric von Dickinson's bestseller Chariot of the Gods, 1968, picked up for paperback in 1971, a book positing that ancient aliens had visited the Earth and guided human development. Like Dyakin, Lindsay wrote with a claim to authority far outstripping his credentials. Lindsay presented himself as a popularizer of scholarly knowledge, like Dyken delivered better insights about the world than the scientific or religious establishments. The critical scholarly reactions to both books in light of massive commercial success were microcosms of the widening ruptures in popular and scholarly knowledge taking place in the 1970s. So I do think that Hummel is making some very interesting observations here about the conditions, okay, that are leading to this. Now, unlike futurist geopolitical books, The Late Great Planet Earth was co-written by a woman. Lindsay's collaborator was C.C. Carlson, credited as something less than a co-author, but more than a ghostwriter. Tucked on the back cover was her full name, Carol C. Colson, a freelance journalist who would go on to author with Lindsay a string of hits after Late Great Planet Earth. And Carlson released, Lindsay and Carlson released Satan is Alive and Well on Planet Earth, 1972. There's A New World Coming, 1973, and The Liberation of Planet Earth, 1974. Each sold in the millions, fueling a commercial demand for dispensational informed commentary that was addressed not only to the faithful, but to an entire segment of the reading public. 5 years older than Lindsay, Carlson had less acclaim to represent boomers, but the stylistic flair of Late Great Planet Earth and was her major contribution. So he goes on to discuss some of those things. Okay, let's see here. Going to the end of the subsection now on page 239. Steeped in dispensational thought and popular style, these writers. Okay, so he mentions a couple other writers here, okay, that are going to come about in the 1970s. Tim LaHaye, who would go on to co-write the Left Behind series, made his first mark on the apocalypse with The Beginning of the End in 1972. Zola Lovett, along with Talbot and Dallas trained Thomas McCall, wrote the popular apocalyptic series Satan in the Sanctuary in 1973 and Raptured in 1975. Let's see. Charismatic dispensationalist Chuck Smith, whose Calvary Chapel movement spread across the country and the globe from its basis in Southern California, modeled his prophecy tracks, quote, Snatched Away, 1976, and End Times, 1978, on Lindsay's countercultural Jesus People prose. Steeped in dispensational thought and populist in style, these writers looked expectantly not only for the rapture and the return of Christ, but for the signs that America was damned and condemned, a heap of chaff whose wheat would be harvested in the twinkling of an eye. Pop dispensationalists captured a large market, much of it unrealized before 1970. At the time, Lindsay's success in defining dispensational language, style, and content came at the expense of the scholastic tradition that had trained him. Lindsay broke with his teachers on numerous issues. His piecemeal embracement of charismatic practices, his fuzzy maintenance of dispensational time and the Church-Israel distinction, his divorce and remarriage, Lindsay would marry three times, and his penchant for date setting, the Achilles heel of the premillennial respectability since the Great Disappointment at every turn. Lindsay's success rebounded less to Dallas than to Zondervan and Batman books. Indeed, to Lindsay himself, the flock of pop dispensational creators in his wake would follow his lead. So there's an emerging here of a pop dispensationalism as a result of the success of Late Great Planet Earth, and then other writers are copying what Lindsay does, and they're trying to mass market these things, and they're stepping away from the scholastic dispensationalism of Dallas. Excuse me, boy, Theological Seminary, okay? And this is going to have a massive impact on what is going on, okay? Now, the second subsection here is prophets and profits, all right? Page 239, by the summer of 1971, with sales of late great Planet Earth rocketing in the hundreds of thousands, Hal Lindsey and Carol C. Carlson were well on their way to making the rapture a term of wide, if shallow, popular American usage. Dozens of pop dispensationalist works flooded the paperback market and solidified the geopolitical prophecy commentary as a burgeoning market. These authors wrote for profit does not necessarily mean that they did not also sincerely hold to dispensationalism. Economic opportunity could just as easily encourage a niched, authentic visions of the future and appeal to slices of the dispensational pie. Zola Levitt and Arnold Frenchenbaum wrote for a small but growing Messianic Jewish community. Tim LaHaye and Chuck Smith reached younger audiences with their growing church and media empires. Jack Van Impe and Mel Koch took to the airwaves and adapted their geopolitical analysis for televangelism. So I've mentioned Jack Van Impe before. Okay, the fusion of creativity and entrepreneurship ensured a future for geopolitical prophecy commentary, albeit an unstable one. As a case in point, by the end of the 1970s, late great Planet Earth was stylistically passé. Okay, conceptualized on campus ministry speaking notes, Hal Lindsey and Carlson's book superficially maintained some of the norms of scholasticism. Lindsey's seminary credentials were in the first sentence of his author biography and repeated references to in text to quote scholars of biblical prophecy gave the appearance that Lindsey was giving voice to wide consensus. This appeal to the theological authority made to bolster Lindsey's credibility harkened to a passing mid-century era of fundamentalist culture. Boy, there's a lot to say about that. I just don't have time in the video. Dropping down, the torrent of popular dispensational works that followed Lindsey exhibited even fewer references to scholastic thought, further widening the breach in the community. Late Great Planet Earth's success instead prompted new, less theologically grounded questions for writers. Why did prophecy commentary need any connection to the scholastics or to formal religious thought of any kind? Why did it need to be limited to the genre of nonfiction? Why did it need to be confined to the medium of print? Lindsey paved the way for dispensational diffusion into all types of media and popular culture in the 1970s, including fiction, film, and music. So the evangelical industrial complex, to borrow a term from Randy White, gets involved and they just start churning out stuff. Superficial, non-scholastic, non-specific dispensational material that just becomes more and more and more watered down as time goes on. Popularizers in Lindsey's wake were more or less independent of oversight by Lindsey, the scholastics, or church hierarchies. Okay, they were only tenuously connected to the world of scholastic dispensationalism, with many of them, like Lindsey, claiming little more than a degree from Dallas or Moody. They held the professors at these institutions in high esteem, but few ran their newest prophecy analysis by Wolvert or Rivery before publishing. The successful among them were flush with money and intent on capturing the spiritual marketplace of the 1970s. They were creative travelers, communicators. Above all, as their fluorescence of books, pamphlets, films, television, and radio shows attested, they were entrepreneurs. The money they made was reinvested in their own creations, mostly media empires and production lines, and became the source of significant personal wealth. The creative pressures of commercialization put immense strain on the dispensational system as constructed by the scholastics. Fiction allowed for speculation and imagination on the part of the writers and more easily facilitated commercialization. Credentials, tests of theological consistency, and institutional affiliations were less important than creative and marketing skills. Book after book and film after film made clear that popular entertainment directed by consumer tastes made a superior dispensational product. Some creatives continued to advance theological arguments, but others paid homage to the scholastic tradition by expanding the market and simply assuming dispensational underpinnings. Now, all of that is absolutely interesting in the analysis of what happened with dispensational theology. Okay, now, he's going to get into here just some other examples of this, some different novels that came out. Frank Allnutt's The Peacemaker, 1978. Faith healer Morris Cirillo's The Omega Project, 1981. Let's see here. Carol Belzit gained attention for her skepticism and professional medical advice and wrote The Seven Last Years, 1979. Trying to pick up the story where late great planet Earth left off. He gets into... And he's quick to point out on 244, Hummel, is that the scholastic nuances were the first victims of popular success. So the core of the understanding of why the rapture was pre-trib, why the second coming was premillennial, get lost in all of this commercialization that is happening. So the scholastic nuances were the first victims of popular success. At the bottom of page 242, there's a paragraph about movies. It talks about the movie A Thief in the Night from 1972, a low-budget rapture movie that its producers estimated would eventually show to over 100 million viewers is mentioned here. I've seen that movie. I saw that movie as a kid. A Thief in the Night and its sequels, A Distant Thunder, 1978, Image of the Beast, 1981, Prodigal Planet, 1983. He's listing out all the different ways that pop culture is, pop dispensationalism is going to influence the culture. He mentions another movie, Years of the Beast, 1981. Evangelistic films created to bring viewers to a pericope of conversion were exploited post-rapture settings from 666, Youth for Christ, 1972, The Early Warning, Missionary Productions, 1981, to Future Tense, Mars Hill Productions, 1990. Uniting these diverse projects, which included wide-ranging and experimental techniques, divergent film styles, and assorted budgets, was a dispensational milieu that most often went unspoken. The dramatic power of the rapture, its luring implications for modern transportation, communications, and economics, and the potentiality, however remote, for global government run by a dictatorial leader overpowered alternative apocalyptic imaginations and on offer in American popular culture, at least in the 1970s. So, it's going to be hard for scholastic dispensationalism to compete with this. And going now to 244 in the end of this subsection, okay, I have skipped a few of the minor details here just for the sake of time. 244, the last paragraph of this subsection, this diffusion of rapture and Armageddon through print, film, and music, he also talked about music, introduced millions of Americans to the imagery of dispensationalism. But mass exposure through diverse media only hastened the incoherence of dispensational theology. Popularizers failed to ask how the media through which they articulated their faith shaped the meanings they conveyed. Like scholastic dispensationalists who disregarded critical perspectives of their own hermeneutical assumptions, these producers and consumers of popular dispensationalism were oblivious to Marshall McLaurin's diagnosis, the medium is the message. They were either ignorant or simply ignored the internal logics of consumerization, the method through which dispensationalism achieved its popularization that decoupled the rapture, the Antichrist, and the tribulation from dispensational theological system. The result was haphazard engagement with dispensationalism along a broad swath of Americans, an engagement that was much more an emotive cry of alienization from post-60s American culture as it was a grappling with the ultimate truth of dispensational teachings. So I think Hummel is kind of onto something here in what happened, how pop dispensationalism stripped dispensationalism of its theological and philosophical underpinnings, put the cookies on the shelf. People are now dealing with it on sort of a popular level, and they have no understanding of why these concepts are even part of what is going on. Okay. Then in the next subsection, he deals with Lindsay and Chuck Smith and the Jesus people. There was a movie made earlier this year, I believe, about Chuck Smith, or maybe it was last year. I can't remember. I did see that movie. I found it interesting. Just as an aside, my dad, when he came to Christ in the 1970s, he listened to Chuck Smith before he really came to an understanding of right division. So he thought the movie was just interesting as a personal a recollection of things that he remembered happening. Okay. Page 245, Lindsay's pop dispensationalism found credence among a segment of young people in just that context, talking about sort of the hippie movement, if you will. As Hal Lindsay introduced apocalyptic images from Daniel and Revelation, a new world opened up, a world God controlled even in its worst moments and promised both to redeem and judge, Hall recalled. Dispensationalism, skepticism on global institutions, especially authority, and modernist thought aligned with the pessimistic assumptions of the world offered by student radicals and rock musicians. So what Hummel's saying now is that this pessimism of dispensationalism is now aligning with other cultural forces. Okay, page 246, talking about Calvary Chapel. Talking about Lonnie Frisbee, some 50 miles south of the Light and Power Company in the city of Costa Mesa, Pastor Chuck Smith and his pupil, a hippie preacher named Lonnie Smith, cultivated an even larger local community of counterculture youth at Calvary Chapel, beginning with what would become the Calvary Chapel movement. Smith, a lifelong Pentecostal ordained in the denomination founded by Amy Sample McPherson, welcome the influx by undertaking a years-long verse-by-verse study of the book of Revelation. Like Lindsay, who eventually came to work at Calvary Chapel in the 1970s, Smith's pop dispensationalism was weighed towards eschatological concerns. In his 1978 book, End Times, Smith set a concrete date for the rapture of 1981 using logic borrowed from Lindsay that the generation shall not pass. Since a generation of judgment is 40 years and a tribulation period lasted 7, I believe the Lord could come back for his church at any time before the tribulation starts, which would mean any time before 1981. He clarified the math, 1948 plus 40 minus 7, 1981. The date came and went, of course, and many more predictions with the hedging of could and may follow was clear. What was clear was that Chuck Smith, like Lindsay, incorporated dispensational theology here insofar as it affirmed or informed his eschatological speculation. So, again, sort of teaching to the lowest common dispensational denominator here, setting a date, the date coming to pass, and then, well, I said maybe, I said could, and sort of the egg on the face post-mortem analysis of why it didn't happen the way that you said it would, which inevitably follows. I mean, we saw this nearly 10 years ago with the Harold Van Kampen thing. I think it was 2012, the rapture was supposed to come, and there were billboards all over America, and of course, it didn't happen. So every time this predictions come to pass, it's more egg on the face for dispensationalism, causing more people to, you know, just abandon the theology because of these crazy predictions. There's a paragraph here, pop dispensationalism and the Jesus people flourished in Southern California and beyond for much of the 1970s. The movement was soon a national phenomenon. Billy Graham grew out his hair a little and capitalized on a youthful energy in his crusades, according to what Hummel says here. One of the more once the embers of impending rapture cooled in the 1980s, the Jesus people left a complicated legacy for thousands of middle-aged boomers, and that informed both the smaller evangelical left and the gathering new Christian right. Bottom of page 246, yet here too, exposure, talking about the beast, word phrases and symbols such as rapture, great tribulation, pre-tribulation, post-tribulation, millennium, antichrist, beast, and 666 were entirely new to me, Hall reminisced. Yet here too, exposure was not to the scholastic dispensationalism of Feinberg, Walward, and Rivery, but to the eschatological motifs of Lindsay, Smith, and Norman. Norman being the musician, Larry Norman. A fractured fundamentalism, recalling Walward's complaint from 1957, could hardly offer more the term evangelical. Only decades won in favor of the evangel or the gospel, but it does not in itself define the term theologically, with little to organize it but a deeply entrenched rivalry. Fundamentalist theology was heavily influenced by commercial and cultural arguments. In one sense, this was the story as old as new premillennialism, hearkening to the efforts of James H. Brooks, Joseph Sees, and Dwight Moody in the 19th century. But in another sense, the Jesus people embrace of apocalyptic theology helped to undermine the legacy and future of dispensationalism on scholastic terms. The same cultural logic that extended pop dispensationalism's reach made it vulnerable to the whims of culture and commerce. When cultural trends shifted and consumer tastes changed, pop dispensationalism would be forced to further adapt or die. Again, this is why, as a people ask me all the time, do you recommend the Left Behind books? No. Do you recommend this? Do you recommend that? No, because they're popular things that are devoid of any sort of real explanation of the key elements, the key things that need to be in place for one to properly understand dispensationalism. The full force of the Bible reading methods enabled dispensationalism came to bear on the Jesus people. Interpreting the Bible in anything but a plain meaning was an undermining of biblical authority. With the windfall profits from bestsellers, Lindsay was described by Publishers Weekly in 1977 as an Adventist, an apocalypse evangelist who sports a Porsche racing jacket and tools around Los Angeles in a Mercedes 450 SL. Lindsay's ministry had little to say about what to do until the end arrived. We wanted our cake, Jesus to return and to eat it too, to live however we wanted to live until he came back. Hall concluded about the Jesus people movement. The spirit of separation would reach beyond the Jesus people and extend to the entirety of the dispensational world over the next decade. So that brings us to the end of chapter 14 on pop dispensationalism. Very pivotal chapter in the book. I think Hummel does make some good and analytical points about how all of this is happening outside of the purview of scholastic organized dispensationalism that had been systematized. And it's certainly also out of the purview of mid-Acts Pauline dispensationalism, which obviously the scholastics never embraced. They thought it was hyper or, you know, too much dispensationalism. So even the scholastics, for all the things that I could learn from them, I think they were off on certain elements of their dispensationalism. But now this is becoming a popular dispensationalism that's devoid of an understanding of the scriptural and philosophical, theological underpinnings of the system, and only focusing on popular issues is going to now preach to the lowest common dispensational denominator. It's going to make popular culture familiar with these concepts. But as popular culture changes, it inevitably does, what now is going to be the fate of dispensationalism is kind of what Hummel is getting at. So when he talks about the rise and fall of dispensationalism, he's really talking about the fall of dispensationalism in its scholastic form as set forth by Dallas Theological Seminary. But this has already been a long video. I'm gonna stop now and just remind you that if you've never trusted Jesus Christ, if you've never relied exclusively on his death on the cross for you, his shed blood, as the only total complete payment for your sin, you need to trust Jesus Christ today before it's everlasting too late. God loves you. Christ died for your sin. He's willing to give you eternal life as a free gift if you would just trust the finished work of his son as the only payment for your sin. Stop relying on your works, your law keeping, your church going, whatever it is that you think is going to make you right before God. We all fall short of the glory of God. We've all sinned. Jesus Christ entered time, took upon himself the form of a servant, took upon himself human flesh, so that he could suffer and make satisfaction for the offended justice of God against sin. Trust Jesus Christ today before it's everlasting too late. Thanks for your attention. We'll see you next time.